This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. This is another one of the Friends series, and we're absolutely delighted that Susanna Hellman today is going to be our curator, who's going to speak about the Baden Journals. It's six manuscript journals kept by some imaginative sisters living in rural New South Wales, at a New South Wales property from 1912 to 1913, when their parents were travelling abroad. So I'll be interested to see quite what their imagination ran to over that period, if their parents were away. So Susanna, thank you very much for coming to speak to us today, and we're looking forward to hearing about these journals. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for coming. Before I begin, I would like to thank the Museum's Registration, Conservation, Photography and Copyright staff who enabled objects and images to be here today. Everything we do at the Museum is such a group effort, and this is a great example of that. Almost 100 years ago, a group of young sisters living on a farm started their own journal. They called each one a Baden Journal. Baden was the name of their family farm in Grongrong, rural New South Wales. I've got a map for you here. Grongrong is the one at the centre where the little compass sign is. Six of these journals survive and were recently donated to the museum. Most of the girls were probably teenagers or younger when they filled each journal with stories, letters, poems and drawings. The journals are significant for a number of reasons, but most of all for the fact that they give us a rich glimpse into the creative and daily lives of these sisters. They show us what the girls were reading, thinking, and doing, and cover a wide range of subjects, from their kittens to their new washing machine. The girls' good humour, curiosity, and generosity are all on full view in the journals, as is a strong inclination for rhyming verse, both copied from elsewhere and composed by themselves. For example, I'd like to read you what they call their wash day song. On the screen, you see a drawing from another of the journals. It obviously matches this poem. I dreamt that I had had all my washing to do in the old style of rubbing and boiling, and to go out then and stand in the sun to me was far worse than mere toiling. But when I awoke, I found 'twas a joke. Since the Baltic has come on the scene, The wash is child's play, and what a gay day the wash day to me does seem. The wash day to me does seem. I'm sure that those of us who have lived without a washing machine can relate to these feelings of joy. Another reason the journals are significant is that they are peppered with German references. For instance, this one. The girls' parents were both from German-speaking backgrounds. The journals show that the girls have fused their German heritage with their Australian daily lives, and in turn, they give us an idea of how the girls view the world. More of that later. So my talk today will explore how the journals illustrate the sisters' lives and German heritage and argue that they provide an unparalleled opportunity to explore the girls' worldviews. Each journal is dated, although only four of these specify the year. The dates are October the 11th, 1912, November the 11th, December the 11th, 1912, January the 11th, February 1913, and April and May numbers. But I think it's very likely that most of them date, that the ones which don't have a year do date from that same period. The journals are all roughly the same size. They have cardboard covers and are decorated differently in coloured pencils and ink. Most are held together by a ribbon binding, as you see here. And this journal is actually on display over to my right. It's the issue for January 1913. Some have pages that have been taken from farm machine catalogues, and one of the journals has suffered more pest damage than others. But overall, the journals retain the colours they must have had when they were first written. The journals were part of a longer series kept by the girls, but family tradition associates these six with the period when the girls' parents were away in Germany before the First World War. Here are some photographs of the Fronda family. It was a large family of two sons and four daughters. Six daughters, and all of the children were born in Australia. This is a picture that dates from the early 1900s. This is a later photo from 1907. Their names, the girls' names, were Sylvia, Valeria, Ellen, Adeline, Edith and Vera. And here is a photo of them, which was probably around the time of the journals, or if not a little bit later. The girls' father, Johannes Adolf Fronda, a German-born Swiss, took their mother to Germany for a medical procedure. One or more of the girls went with them. The remaining children were left on their family farm, and Adolf is said to have charged the girls with having something to show for the time they were alone and encouraged them to maintain these journals. By alone, I think their brothers actually stayed behind as well, so... Exactly when and for how long Mr. and Mrs. Fronda were away is unknown. But it's obvious that producing the journals was a team effort and that most of the Fronda daughters wrote in them. That the girls were proud of their work is shown by the fact that they have been meticulous enough to attribute pages to their respective authors. For this, they use pen names. Here are some photos of the pen names. And some of these are German. For instance, Schwarzwald, Zieten, then there's Australian Barley, Big Baby Original, Banma, and from our correspondent. Schwarzwald, the name meaning Black Forest, is the most prolific and sophisticated of the authors. Zieten is probably a misspelling of Zieten. Sorry, I'm not a German speaker, but it's Z-E-I-T-E-N, which means the times, age, or epoch. Interestingly, the word Barley... was used by the family to make people stop what they were doing. We don't know very much about the girls' lives at this time or what it was like for them to be without their parents. The journals have come down through the family of the second youngest Fronda daughter, Edith, who was born in 1900. She would have been about 12 or 13 at around the time of the journals. She was also one of the authors and used the pen name Australian Barley, which you see in the centre. One of the sisters, probably the one who wrote Schwarzwald, was a skilled seamstress and artist. The family has told us that after the period of the diaries, some of the girls died from tuberculosis. More information is available about their father, Adolf, born in 1859 in Königsfeld, Baden, in the Black Forest area of what is now Germany. Adolf came out to Australia seeking greater opportunity. Documents held by the National Archives of Australia show that he arrived in Melbourne in mid-January 1880 on the three-masted square-rigged vessel La Rochelle, which embarked from Hamburg. Adolf was then 20 years old and well-educated. He settled first in Victoria, where he worked in a pub, then moved to New South Wales, share farming in the Kawabi area near Coolamon. At some point, he married a Victorian-born woman of German descent. In 1905, he applied for naturalisation, and his form, in his own hand, shows that by birth he was a German subject. Had lived in Victoria for 15 years, Wagga Wagga for 5 years, and Grong Grong for 5 years. From this evidence, it's likely that the family moved to their farm, Baden, hence Baden Journals, obviously, at Grong Grong in around 1900. As the son of a teacher, Adolf Fronda placed an emphasis on his children's education, sending them to a nearby school. They had to walk 3 miles there and back each day. At some point, the family had a teacher boarding at the farm. One of Adolf's acquaintances, writing in the newspaper The Land in 1970, described him as a man of culture when he ultimately settled on Kwabi West, and he met with all the vicissitudes of a pioneer. Adolf was a successful gardener and ran in a large orchard at Baden. In a document dating to 1926, he described his occupation as farmer and grazier and is listed as owning 1,959 acres. He was known in the nearby town for his German sausages, probably made from his own pigs and sheep. The family's home stood until several years ago, and the farm itself is currently run by one of Adolf's descendants. So in a broader context, the journals offer an opportunity to study as a group of second-generation Swiss-German Australians. In 1912-1913, Australia had a strong history of German immigration, particularly to rural areas, and many prominent explorers, missionaries, scientists, artists, and others of German and Swiss origin, it now claimed it as its own. The Gold Rush was a peak period for German immigration, as was the period around the time that Adolf came to Australia. In total, between 1840 and 1890, around 70,000 people from Germanophone countries settled in Australia. Many raised large families here. The journals date the years just prior to the First World War encourages other questions. Why were they returning to Germany? As German speakers, how did the Frondes fare in a rural community at a time when, as historian Johannes Voigt put it, in the general hysteria of war, everything was put in the pillory, everything that was German and regarded as potentially disloyal. Adolf was not interned during the First World War. Although he was born in Königsfeld, as his father and mother were both Swiss citizens, he had secured a form of patriality, Heimatschein, when he was 19 years old. Documents held by the National Archives of Australia make it clear that in 1916, he was regarded as a Swiss native, naturalised British subject. Swiss Australians were generally left alone during both world wars, according to Swiss historian Suzanne Wegmann. The same article I mentioned earlier, published in The Land on the 28th of May 1970, suggests that he was believed to have a connection to Alsace, the area between France and Germany that has for centuries been passed back and forth between the rulers of France and Germany. Alsace was generally seen as a pawn of war, I think, at this time, and certainly probably during the First World War. Alsace, Germany, France and Switzerland are contiguous. I mentioned earlier that the girls write in the journals under pen names. Their using both Anglophone and German names shows their ability to fuse their heritage. The family has told us that although they could not speak German, the girls often used German words in English contexts. Adolf himself was known for using many German words when speaking English. The journals reflect the German flavour of the girls' lives, as Germanic references pepper the journals. For instance, there's a drawing of a traditional German beer vessel that you saw before, a drawing of the German Kaiser, or what may represent a German Kaiser. It doesn't have a label. 1913 was also the year of the Kaiser's Jubilee. Unfortunately, I don't have a photograph of it. My photograph wasn't that great. And there are also transfers of German steamers, which you see on the left, one of which you'll see on the left. The drawing of the Kaiser may show that the girls were keeping abreast of overseas news and growing German nationalism. The transfers may have been made more relevant to the girls through the fact that from the late 19th century, German steamers were visiting Australia. At the same time, there are also references to Australia in the journals. For example, pages celebrating Empire Day and a poem about Australia. The poem begins, "O Australia, fair and lovely, Empress of the Southern Sea, what a glorious fame awaits thee in the future's history." Where this came from is actually unclear in the journal, but obviously Schwarzwald, whose name is at the foot of the page, had strong feelings about Australia. As I said at the beginning of this talk, the journals illustrate the girls' daily lives and creative preoccupations. The journal's content seemed to fall into three different categories: pages which tell of the girls' lives at Baden in a factual way, fictional poems, stories and illustrations, and finally, illustrations, poems and stories taken from books they've been reading. So I think we'll explore these topics in that order. There are actually relatively few pages that explore life on Baden in a dry, factual way. Most information is conveyed as part of a story or a poem. Several of the journals have illustrations of farm animals that seem to be inserted at random without any accompanying text. For example, these that you see on the screen. There is also this page about building a house, which feels like it is something the artist is doing both to record what she's seen and possibly for the instruction of one of her sisters. One of the most interesting features of the journals is a letter to baby. They're all called letter to baby, mostly in rhyming verse, suggesting that they were written when their youngest sibling was away, accompanying their parents to and from Germany. Schwarzfeld wrote these. Each letter gives news of the weather and how this has affected the farm, the family's kittens, and the girl's health. At one point, one of the girls had the measles. My favourite is that from January the 1913. It speaks to all of these points, but with added humour. Dear baby, now Christmas is over once more, and a new year is started again. I hope all the good resolutions have not been made in vain. Our dear little kittens are all quite well, and would you really believe, some of the people around here declare that they are thieves. Eddie finished harvesting the day before yesterday, and now all the men are busy carting in the last of the hay. We went to town the other day, my sister Val and I, and got a thorough soaking. I felt cold enough to die. The fruit is not very ripe just now, and the birds are most troublesome. I think they are worst of all on the delicious Japanese plum. Our pony is very flash just now and won't stop when we call out, "Halt!" With best wishes for a prosperous new year, from your loving Schwarzfeld. Other pages refer to a series of true stories, for example, and those words are put in quotations, for example, a page-long story telling of Edith, one of the girls, homesickness when she stayed in town for a few days. There are also stories about their kittens, their birds, or birds on the farm, and their pony called Maud. She even has her own poem. There's also a couple of diary-type entries. Christmas also features in the journals. You might have noticed at the beginning that one of the journals is a Christmas issue. And you'll see it on your left here. The most prominent page about Christmas at Baden is in the December 1912 issue. With its illustrated heading, it has a page of verse, and I'll read it to you now. Dainty little stockings hanging in a row, blue and grey and scarlet in the moonlight show. Baden Farm is standing there, tidied all around, awaiting Father Christmas to alight upon the ground. Curly-headed sleepers safely tucked in bed, dreams of wondrous toy shops dancing through each head. Little sleepers waking, bless me, what a noise. Wish you Merry Christmas, happy girls and boys. This was by Zeiten, or at least written by her. There are numerous stories. They must have composed themselves. I'd like to pick out three poems which they don't attribute to anyone else. This first speaks to the value of literacy. A kitten has no work to do. She frisks about all day, but she can't write as I can. All she can do is play. There are other verses about birds. The second is a humorous one about owls. You see on the right? Old Granny Owl, so grave and wise, blinked solemnly with big round eyes and said, "My dears, 'tis sad to see how greedy little owls can be," etc. The third records how Schwarzfeld's cat caused her to drop and break her doll. "Alas, alas, my doll is broken, my dolly so grand and new. And oh, it is your fault, pussy, that its head lies there in two. For if you had not got in my way, I wouldn't have stumbled, you see. And my pretty little dolly would still be as lovely could be. But never mind, dear pussy, don't look at me so sad, for tomorrow I'll buy a new dolly, newer than I've ever had." The degree to which the journals are inventive and wholly original is unclear. As well as recognising each author, the girls have frequently made it clear when they have transcribed or adapted work from other places. This is more common in some of the journals than others. This sort of referencing is invaluable to the historian, surprising as well as making the journals even more interesting in themselves. Investigating the works they have referenced is a very interesting exercise, but it can also be quite confusing as they have not provided publication dates. One has, for instance, the title of Holiday Annual, a title that is hard to identify. At the same time, several of these works can be identified with some confidence. Unfortunately, these books have not remained in the family. The books are most likely to have been English publications transported to Australia. In this way, and in theory, the journals would allow us to study in microcosm the impact of English children's publishing on Australia at this time. Names of the attributed works are The Animal Land, Sea Magazine, which might be children's magazine, Fairyland Stories, Our Darlings, Holiday Annual, Teddy Bear Tales, Little Friends, Bo Peep and Catland. Bo Peep is likely to be the work published by Castle from 1895, subtitled A Treasury for Little Ones. It is hard to access these works in Australian collections as relatively few of them survive. A closer investigation of the journals against these books could resolve this issue further. Our Darlings, Catland and possibly Animal Land are the works of English artist Louis Wayne. He lived between 1860 and 1939. He was famous for his books and illustrations about anthropomorphic cats. British writer H.G. Wells famously commented on Wayne, "He has made the cat his own. He invented a cat style, a cat society, a whole cat world." English cats that do not live like Louis Wayne cats are ashamed of themselves. Louis Wayne was extremely popular for decades. He was also enormously prolific. His cat drawings appeared in children's books, written by others, on postcards, as drawings for sale, in journals, and in books and annuals published under his own name. On the left-hand side, you see his annual. That was one of the covers. A quick search of the Times, now a database, follows his fortunes from fame to raising funds for stray cats in 1901, falling off an omnibus in 1914, to mental ill health late in life. He suffered from schizophrenia, and although he was institutionalised, he continued to produce cat drawings. His obituary in the Times in 1939 summarises his fame. "For some 20 years before the war," talking about the First World War, I think, "it may be safely said that his name was known in nearly every British household. In his drawings, he treated cats as human beings, showing them in comical situations, and his work made him one of the most popular artists of his generation." This is another of his drawings, in the city, shopping hours. Wayne's popularity has revived since his death, and each year a London gallery has a cat show. I'd like to finish with this page, though, that Edith Frunder, writing as Australian Barley, has taken from Animal Land. "Clothes do not make a gentleman, oh please remember that. Although proud puss would fain be one, he still remains a cat. True gentleness is in the heart, no matter how you're dressed. It is in the things you think and do that show what you are best." So like Louis Wayne, the Frunder sisters created their own imaginative world. The journals allow us to enter this world, if only for a few months of their lives, giving us an idea of how they related to each other, to their pets, their farm, their books, and their Swiss-German heritage. We can see things from their perspective. We can delight in the skillful and humorous work they've left us, and we can rediscover the literature that captured them. Just as an addendum, I'd like to add that although they won't be going on display in the first iteration of Australian Journeys, which opens this December, we hope that they will be on display in that gallery in a couple of years' time. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.